This is Mac Format This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features from the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up on this edition, are you ready for a new iPod?
The theme with the new iPods is definitely evolution and not revolution, but it was a very solid lineup before, and what Apple's done has just made it even more solid now.
We've got all the details of the revamped iPods with Chris Finn. Also ahead, the pros and cons of AppleCare.
Extended warranties have a very bad reputation in the electronics industry, but Apple's AppleCare warranty could be a real lifesaver if you rely on your Mac to help run your business.
Cliff Joseph gives you valuable tips on deciding if an Apple extended warranty is right for you. All that and more on this expanded edition of Mac Format This Week. With the resources of Mac Format Magazine, this is Mac Format This Week. Hello again, everyone. I'm Brad Gibson. On the 9th of September, Apple took the wraps off a revamped line of iPods, unveiling the fourth generation iPod Nano with a boost in capacity to 16 gigabytes and a huge range of colors, and three new versions of the iPod Touch. In addition, Apple upgraded the iPod Shuffle and reinvigorated the iPod Classic into a slimmer size at a cheaper price. We've got all the developments for you in this edition of Mac Format This Week, and we'll also focus on a new version of iTunes, iTunes 8, that generates a smart playlist of similar music based on one song. We've got lots to cover, and joining us to do just that is Mac Format Magazine Deputy Editor Chris Finn. Hello, Chris.
Hello there, Brad.
Well, these announcements were met by some as disappointing, Chris, but I'm not sure why. There's something really new for everyone in the announcements from Steve Jobs just in time for Christmas, and I'm sure that's no coincidence. Let's begin with a product that has the biggest changes, and that's the Nano. New slimmer look, touted as the slimmest iPod ever in a curved aluminum and glass design. There are two models in nine colors, a 109-pound version with 8 gigabytes of memory, enough for about 2,000 songs, and a 16-gigabyte version, which holds 4,000 songs for £149. Compared to the older models, consumers will get double the capacity for the same price. Chris, give us your thoughts on these new Nanos, and tell us about the pretty cool new features that it has.
Well, thoughts first of all. It does, in some ways, isn't it, hark back to the original iPod Nanos. It's tall and slim. It's a change from the little sort of little fatty ones that we've had recently. Still phenomenal value, still I'm sure going to be the most popular iPod out there because it's at that perfect sweet spot between capacity and price. The new designs are lovely. The new colours are fantastic. Really, really bright, strong colours, look really good. The screen's very bright, very strong, very crisp and clean. Mm-hmm. Unlike on the current iPod Nano where they've sort of tried to jammy in a two-column display, this is now just a single clean column display with the click wheel interface that you're used to. The cool new stuff you're talking about is, well, there's two things. One, it's got an accelerometer built into it, same as the iPod and Touch and the iPhone has. The idea there is if you're watching video, you can just turn it on its side and the video will flip because the screen in normal use is portrait. The screen will flip to landscape, let you watch your video. Very nice. The other thing that the accelerometer allows you to do is it senses when the iPod is being shaken so that if you want to shuffle your track, if you listen to some music, you want to shuffle, you want to just listen to a new random track, you just shake the iPod and it will flick you onto a new random track.
Now, I did... Now, that's something that Dell would never do, would they?
Absolutely. It's a nice touch. I have to say, I played with these when I was at the launch in Islington a couple of nights ago. I didn't get a chance to go through the menu system, but I'm sure there's an option to turn that off. Because if you're using your iPod Nano for jogging, I'm sure that could get very irritating very quickly.
Yeah, that could be very irritating for sure. All right, let's move on to the iPod Touch. It's slightly lighter at 4.05 ounces, now sports a contoured design and the same tapered curved look on the back as the iPhone 3. It also adds integrated volume control buttons and a built-in speaker, now has Nike Plus as a receiver built in, and offers improved battery life at 36 hours of music playback versus the old model at 22 hours. Here's the pricing: an 8-gigabyte model at £169, a 16-gigabyte version at £219, and a new 32-gigabyte model that stores 7,000 songs for £289. So all in all, Chris, a nice update to the Touch.
Yeah, it's a really nice little thing. The styling of it, as you say, really mimics the iPhone. It's got a metal trim around the edge rather than the sort of black plastic chamfered look that the original iPod Touch had. The back, as you say, is a sort of curved design, chamfered design, same as the iPhone 3G. Although the back of this one is still a shiny metal finish rather than being plastic, which is in some ways it's a very pretty thing. And I was talking to Graham, the editor, about this the other day, and he was saying it looks as if when you hold it in your hands upside down, face down, it looks almost like a little blob of mercury sitting there. It's a very pretty little thing, but it does mean it gets scratched really badly, the same as all these iPods have done.
Yeah, I'm not really crazy about that back with it. I think it's going to get scratched a lot. I really do.
Yeah, it is very pretty. And remember, Steve Jobs said, well, you know, at least your iPod rather is becoming personalised to you. It's no other iPod looks exactly the same as yours on the back, which is one way of putting it, certainly. But, you know, features are what matter. And as you say, we've got external volume controls, which we didn't have before, which is really, really handy. If you've got your iPod in your pocket, you don't have to take it out, put the screen on, adjust the volume. You can just reach into your pocket and click the volume up or down, which is fantastic. We have, as you say, a built-in speaker, same as with the iPhone. And again, Apple went to some lengths to say it's for sort of occasional listening only, i.e. don't expect to be listening to high-fidelity music through this. But I find I really like on my iPhone the fact that it's got built-in speaker so that I can put a podcast on, or I can put on an audiobook and have it sitting by my bed, put it on to sleep, and I'll go to sleep listening to that. So it's good enough for that.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, the really cool thing, built-in Nike Plus. Now, the Nike Plus system, if you remember, is the idea that you put a little receiver in the sole of one of your shoes, a special Nike shoe that's got a little hole for it. You put that in there. You, in the past, plugged a receiver into your iPod Nano, and you went running, and you could set up special running playlists and stuff, and it could give you countdowns, and you could say, I want to do 1,000 yards, I want to do a 2-kilometer run, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all that functionality is built directly into the iPod Touch. You don't have to add that external dongle. And there's a really cool UI for all the Nike Plus stuff directly onto the iPod Touch. You can go in and have a look at your stats and stuff on the iPod rather than having to download stuff to your Mac or PC and look at it there.
The rumors of the iPod Classic's demise were greatly exaggerated, Chris. I mean, it's been reinvigorated with a 120-gigabyte hard drive squished into the 80-gigabyte slim frame for the same price of £179, so you get more music for your money. But its fatter brother, the 160-gigabyte model, is gone. Why do you think that happened?
It's difficult to say. I mean, the claim that Apple makes is that the 160-gig model, the thick one, didn't sell all that well, and the sort of implication was that that's because it was fat. But I don't think that's quite the case. It was expensive, but it was one of those things that I liked having that one there in the iPod lineup, because for people with huge music collections, that's the only possible one to go for.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, the 120-gig for the same price, 180 quid, is very good, but the biggest iPod now has had its capacity cut effectively by 40 gigabytes, and that's a lot of music. I think we're beginning to see people. The sort of people buying iPods aren't the sort of people with enormous music collections, or if they are, the sort of people who don't mind putting a subset of their music collections onto their iPod with them when they go. It seems like the days of the sort of big jukeboxes are sort of gradually fading away. And I actually miss that, because I'm one of those people that likes to have everything with me. It annoys me that my iPhone can only carry a tiny fraction of my music collection. I'd like to have the bigger one.
Yeah, it really does. Let me briefly mention that the Shuffle wasn't mentioned at the Jobs address, but it did get a revamp. It now comes in more vibrant shades of silver, blue, green, red, and purple colors that were previously available. It continues to ship in 1 gigabyte and 2 gigabyte capacities for £32 and £45, respectively. Now, let's talk about the only non-hardware announcement from Jobs, the new release of iTunes version 8. It ties into new features available at Apple's online iTunes store, including the ability to download and watch TV programs in high definition, and also now lets you browse by album and video covers. But its biggest addition is a feature called Genius. Chris, tell us what's Genius about Genius.
It's basically a music recommendation engine. It sort of fingerprints your music collection, looks at what you've listened to. We don't know the exact details of it, but I imagine it's looking at play counts and star ratings for the music that's in your collection. It's sent all up to Apple. Apple analyzes it, and it can then make recommendations on the music that you like based on what you like already. It works in two different ways. When you select a song in iTunes, you can have a Genius sidebar. On the right-hand side of the screen, you get a sidebar showing, which shows you top songs you're missing, i.e. songs that are on the iTunes store that you could go and buy but that you don't currently own. So you can have a preview of those, and there's one-click buy buttons everywhere all over that thing. So you can discover new music that way. The thing that has more mass appeal is the fact that you can be listening to a track, you can hit a Genius button, and it will create a playlist for you that's 25, 50, or 100 songs in length from your own music collection that it thinks are similar to the track that you're listening to at the moment. So if you're listening to a track by Bon Jovi, click that Genius button and you'll get a bunch of other tracks in your collection that are sonically the same sort of things as Bon Jovi. Now, some of the recommendations are very good. If you're listening to obscure music or not particularly mainstream music, you will it'll struggle. But the genius of the system, if you'll excuse the pun, is that as more people do it, the recommendations will get better and better and better over time.
Just how intelligent does it actually get? Does it learn what you pick and refine the searches, or is it not that intelligent?
I don't know, is the honest answer. We don't know what the sort of secret sauces Apple's put into place with this. We do know that the recommendations will improve simply because it's that sort of crowdsourcing thing. The more that people listen to stuff and the more people that upgrade to iTunes 8 and get their tracks fingerprinted and sent up to the service, the more sophisticated the recommendations will become. I've listened to a particular artist a few dozen times and that's it. It will know when I'm trying to compare that to different artists that I don't really care about that similarity. And the more that happens, the more people that do it, the better the recommendation should become.
Yeah. But Chris, this ability to recommend tracks based on music you select is new to iTunes, but not new in the music world.
That's absolutely true. There's a bunch of services. You've got things like The Filter, you've got things like Last.fm and iLike, which will do similar things. And in fact, I'm a bit annoyed at Apple because iTunes 8 broke iLike. Before iTunes 8, I used the iLike sidebar, which is a nice little service. It looks very similar to the way that Apple's doing it with iTunes. Mm-hmm. Same thing, as you listen to tracks, it will pull down recommendations, you can preview. But there's a couple of things I prefer about that. One of them is it will also show you tracks that are free, that are tracks from sort of upcoming artists, and they're trying to do some promotion for themselves. So if they've been influenced by Radiohead and you're listening to Radiohead, their track will appear and you can download them for free. The other thing is there's a sort of social aspect to it as well that will allow me to see what my friends are listening to directly from within the iTunes window. And Last.fm as well, I really like, because it doesn't show you music recommendations based on tracks you already own, but instead will pull down and stream tracks to you that you don't own, which is, I think, is a much better way of discovering new music, because by definition, you don't own them.
Right, right. You mentioned The Filter a minute ago. Well, joining us now to discuss Genius and how it compares to The Filter service is David Mayer Roberts, the CEO of the Peter Gabriel-funded recommendation engine, The Filter. David, your company released a press statement after the rollout of iTunes 8 saying that you, quote, genuinely welcome what Apple is endeavoring to do with Genius, unquote. But I expect you're going to tell us that The Filter is different and better.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we welcome it genuinely because actually attracts attention to the space, and the fact that anywhere where you have an awful lot of content, you're going to need filtering tools to be able to navigate and find the stuff that you're going to like. So that's why we welcome it. However, obviously, we do things slightly differently. I think for starters, we use not just your purchase patterns to decide what goes with what. We also use consumption and browsing and any other piece of data that might give us evidence of your tastes. That's quite important. We also do this across all different types of media, so music and movies. We use your taste to filter news feeds from the entertainment space. We have about 200 news feeds that we filter every day for that. So that's one of the reasons we're different from that point of view. And I guess the other two differences is we believe very much in a blend of artificial intelligence to find what music goes with what or what movies go with what, blending that with what your friends think. So we use your friends' tastes, and we're very much pushing that in the next few versions of the site. You will see a huge development in that from The Filter. And the final point actually is that we try and do this all in an open architecture, because our real aim is to allow people to almost carry their taste with them where it's the most important for them.
Besides the differences that you just mentioned, there's another big difference, and that is Apple is more interested in selling more content and making money, where you feel The Filter is more about offering a good experience, but you're still making some money in other ways too.
Sure. I mean, ultimately, everybody has to make money, and there's no harm in the fact that Apple are doing this to try and sell more content, because actually, if they do it right, they'll also make it a better user experience and connect people more easily to the content that they want. So
right.
we're about the discovery journey And that's discovering not only through your own tastes, but through the through your friends, through a social discovery, which is actually quite fun. And we used to always do it in the UK down the pub, where you would ask your friends for what they'd watched, what they'd seen, what to watch on TV. And for us, the filter is the extension of that. But because the world is so much bigger in terms of content, there's so much more choice, we think you need some artificial intelligence help to reduce the 5 million things down to maybe 100 or 200, and then you can choose from that.
Okay, now let's talk about the technology differences between the two and try and break it down in simple layman's terms for people, because this is new to a lot of people, especially with the advent of Genius from Apple and iTunes 8. Give us an idea from what you know about Genius, because Apple's not telling us very much about how it works. What is the difference in terms of their performance and how they work?
Yeah, it's hard to comment exactly on what Apple are doing, because I'm guessing. So I can tell you first how we do things, because we're fairly open about that. You know, we use a branch of artificial intelligence called Bayesian maths, which is a statistical engine. In layman's terms, it basically looks in all the purchase patterns and consumption patterns, so what people have bought in a session and what people have listened to in a session. And those connections, we basically give them a weight, and we work out what connection there is between every single song and every single artist based on these millions and millions of transactions or plays. That means that when you have all of that information, you can build a pick list of songs, basically like a playlist, from any song in the database in a decreasing order of probability. So it'll say, you start with Take On Me by A-ha, and then everything in the database, all the other songs that are the most likely to go with that, start appearing underneath it in the decreasing order of probability. So that's how we do it, and that's what we call raw probability. The difference with us is we then apply filters to that information, like what your personal taste is. And those filters will positively or negatively bias the results according to your tastes. So that's one of the differences that we do.
Does the filter actually learn and become more intelligent based upon what you do and do not use? Because we can't get a sense with Genius if that is available in Apple's Genius or not.
Yeah, I can't tell yet if that's available or not. The Bayesian approach is a learning intelligence agent. So it does learn about not only the changes in all of the people's stuff that we are looking at, the data. You know, it spots changes in the trends. But the other thing that we do is, for individuals, critically, it also forgets. The ability to learn and forget is quite important. So every piece of information that we put in the database, we add a half-life to it, or a decay, to make sure that if we have no more evidence that you're into it, then the influence of that thing will decrease. So there's no obvious evidence in Genius that that's currently in place, but I certainly wouldn't put it past Apple to add that in the future, you know, without a doubt.
So before people who listen to this go to thefilter.com and try out your product and learn more about it, first of all, people need to know, does the filter filter music from iTunes?
Yes, yeah, so you can actually, there's a plugin that you can download on thefilter.com. We offer a recommendation service that exists as a website, and the more you tell us about yourself, the more we can make the experience personalized. And one of the ways you can tell us about yourself is download the iTunes or WMP or Winamp plugin. And it sits behind your media player, it scans your library, it knows what you're listening to, and therefore learns about your tastes. Our plugin allows you to build playlists as well with one click, same way as Genius. And, you know, we've been doing this for a good 2 years, so we've perfected the algorithms in that sense. And you can build great playlists within that. And as soon as you want to discover new music, at the moment, you can go to thefilter.com and do that as well.
This intelligent type of filtering is becoming so much more popular. Without giving away trade secrets as to the future of this type of filtering system, give us an idea of where this is going. I mean, this is really the infancy of it, is it right?
Absolutely. And every time I talk about this, I feel that we, the filter, and Last.fm, and, you know, other services in the film area, are at the very early stages. We feel we're more advanced than most, but we're very much in the infancy of understanding the key points, which is what activity that people do online when they interact with either content or with other people. What activity is important? What data do they produce with that activity? And can services like ours, can we make sense of that activity and that data to actually provide a very useful service in finding more stuff or more content that will suit people's tastes? And I think we are very early stage. And I think that's why I'm personally very excited about it, because we're starting to see some great advances in actually converting people. So I'll give you an instance. The companies that use our service, typically 40% of everything that they sell comes from a recommendation. And I think that's, we're still at the very early stages. So I think that can be way higher, and we could really help drive not only company sales that way, but we can drive people's interest, because instead of being offered a load of irrelevant or content that they just don't have time to mess around with, the stuff that they're getting is stuff that they will actually more likely enjoy.
David, thanks for joining us and telling us more about The Filter.
You're welcome.
David Marr Roberts is CEO of TheFilter.com. One of the inevitabilities of life is that electronic gadgets break down. We've all been there. A TV, VCR, a computer breaks, and more often than not, they fail, yes, just a few weeks after the warranty ends. Apple products are no exception to the rule. While the majority work flawlessly for longer than we'd ever expect, some end up as lemons when we least expect it. So is Apple's extended warranty plan, better known as AppleCare, a worthwhile investment? Contributing writer Cliff Joseph investigated the pros and cons of AppleCare in an informative 4-page piece in the September issue. He joins us now from London to offer some helpful advice on considering an extended warranty. Cliff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Brad. Good to be back.
I think the best place to begin is with you telling us, what is AppleCare and what do you get for the money?
AppleCare is basically that much maligned beast in the consumer electronics industry. It's an extended warranty plan. You can buy it at the same time as your Mac, and it will extend the standard 1-year warranty to a total of 3 years. You can also get a AppleCare warranty for iPods, Apple TV, monitors, and one or two other bits and pieces as well.
In the UK, consumers are somewhat protected by the Sales of Goods Act, which states that a manufacturer's products must fit for purpose for up to 6 years from the date of purchase. So what is this protection, and why do people need AppleCare versus the Sales of Goods Act, which many people think covers them and protects them?
Now, there's a slight – some people misunderstand the Sale of Goods Act. The Sale of Goods Act does specify that the product must be fit for purpose, but it doesn't specify for 6 years. The 6 years time period is actually the maximum time limit within which you can make a claim against a manufacturer.
It's not the same thing
as having a 6-year warranty.
Okay, so that clears that up. Why do you need AppleCare, and really, who is it best for?
Well, why do you need any insurance policy, really? You buy it in the hope that you'll never need it.
Right.
But for a small number of people, they will need it, and it could turn out to be an absolute lifesaver. The people that get the most benefit from it will be people who rely on their Mac for work, especially if you're a self-employed person or you run a small business and you use your Mac to run your business. Obviously, if the Mac breaks down, that's your business breaking down as well. So the sooner you can get it fixed and the more cheaply you can get it fixed, the better.
Okay, so give us an idea of the cost of AppleCare, not only with Macs, but with iPods as well.
It varies a little bit from model to model. For the Mac Mini, which is the cheapest of all current Mac models, the AppleCare warranty is £129. That increases to £139 for an iMac. Notebooks are a little bit more expensive. Most of the notebooks are £199. The Mac Pro desktop machines are also £199. The MacBook Pro is £279. That's the most expensive.
So what about iPods? They are a lot cheaper, aren't they?
Obviously the iPods themselves are cheaper, so you don't want to spend more than £100 on a warranty for an iPod that costs £30. The cheapest iPod at the moment is the iPod Shuffle. That costs £32 for the Shuffle, and the AppleCare for the Shuffle costs £25.
Okay, now on iPods, the hardware repair or the additional warranty on hardware repairs is one additional year for 2 years total. And on CPUs, meaning laptops or desktops, it's two additional years for a total of 3 years, right?
That's correct, yep.
Okay, now those are the costs. Give us an idea of what kind of extended warranty you actually get on iPods and CPUs because of AppleCare.
Well, when you buy a new Mac, the standard warranty has two components. You get a one-year warranty on the actual hardware. So if the hardware breaks down, that's covered for 1 year. And if it breaks down within that 1 year, you can get it replaced or fixed free of charge. The second component is telephone technical support. Now, for a Mac, that's 90 days of telephone technical support, which is handy because it doesn't just cover technical problems with the hardware. It can also cover things like some of the bundled software that comes with the machine, such as the iLife programs like GarageBand, iMovie, and iDVD. Mm-hmm. So if you're having trouble getting those working, you can ring up Apple and ask for a bit of help.
Yeah, so basically you start with 90 days of technical support on all those products and 1 year of hardware. And then if you want to, before the warranty ends in that 1 year, you can then add AppleCare. You don't have to add it immediately upon buying the product, right?
That's correct. As long as you buy it within the first year, while the initial 1 year warranty is still current, you can leave it until the very last minute. So that gives you a little bit of time to save up the extra money.
Now, Cliff, we talked a minute ago about the price of AppleCare for iPods. And quite frankly, you don't have to be a genius to look at it and say it might not be worth it on some of those cheaper iPods like the Shuffle.
That's correct. So if you're buying something like an iPod Shuffle for £32, by the time the initial 1 year warranty expires, the chances are there'll be another version of the Shuffle being released that is got higher capacity and probably only cost £25 anyway. So with the really cheap iPods, it may not be worth it. On the other hand, with something like an iPod Touch, which is, you know, you could spend easily a couple of £100 on that, and you want it to last for a couple of years, I would have thought. So maybe then the AppleCare warranty makes more sense.
Now, obviously, people think that a warranty is to cover hardware only. But like you said a minute ago, one of the really great benefits of AppleCare is that additional unlimited calls for technical support extended to 2 years. That in itself, especially when you add the fact that it also covers Apple software like iWork and that kind of thing, really adds the real value, in my opinion, to AppleCare.
Oh, yeah, that can be very handy. Because as you said, it, as well as covering the basic iLife programs that come bundled with every Mac, it also covers other Apple products such as iWork. So if you're having any trouble getting your presentations working in Keynote, you can ring Apple and ask them for a bit of help. That only applies to Macs, though. With the technical support for iPods is a single call, one single telephone call within the first 90 days. And after that, you have to pay extra. So that could be where it's worth paying a little extra for the warranty.
Okay.
Because that extends the technical support to a full 2 years.
Okay, so just one phone call with AppleCare, additional one for the iPods, but for the CPUs and laptops and desktops, it's unlimited for that 2 years.
It's unlimited for the first 90 days as part of the standard warranty. And when you buy AppleCare, the technical support is extended to a full 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so really, AppleCare is for those who really see the value of that unlimited technical support that they really need, that hand-holding where they would really need some help every once in a while, but also for those who their Mac is really important to their everyday needs and work.
Absolutely, yes, especially with things like notebooks, because the AppleCare warranty gives you global support. So if you're on a business trip in America or somewhere wandering around Europe and your MacBook dies on you, you can get it replaced wherever you are, which obviously, you know, if you're on a business trip is very useful.
Yeah, and that is a real peace of mind. It really is.
Absolutely.
All right, Cliff, thanks so much for explaining to people what AppleCare is and why it might be best for their needs. Thanks so much.
Anytime, Brad.
Cliff Joseph is a contributing writer to MacFormat magazine. His investigation of AppleCare is on page 20 in the September issue. An application launcher and a Finder window manager are our picks of the month as we look at shareware from the September issue with shareware guru Craig Grinnell. Craig, thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Brad. How are you doing?
I'm very good. We've got two great products to review this month. They are Application Wizard and Simple Window Sets. And let's begin with Application Wizard 2.3.2. You launch and quit app groups, and you can preview your Mac's media on this application. It's $19, about £10, from mabasoft.net/products. And you can also get to it through our enhanced podcast link. Now, there are a lot of launchers for the Mac out there, Craig. So what sets Application Wizard apart from the crowd?
Well, mostly it's that grouping function that you mentioned in your intro. I know there are a lot of apps out there that enable you to sort of create groups of apps for launching. The difference with Application Wizard is it enables you to launch them all at once via a single click, and you can also quit and switch groups by a single click as well.
Okay, so how does this work? What's the interface like?
Well, the interface is a little bit odd in some ways. What it basically does is provide you with four coloured buttons, kind of like the close, zoom buttons, all that sort of thing in a Finder window. Mm-hmm. But they go inside your menu bar. And so there are four of these. There's open, quit, switch, and special. And these all provide access to submenus, and your application groups that you define are actually found within those. So, for example, the quit menu will give you sort of submenus like for office apps or design apps or something like that, and then you can quit all of your apps at once if you need to. They also provide a bunch of other options. So the quit menu lists all of your open apps, so you can quit them all individually. The open menu provides access to your apps folder, dock items, and recent items as well from the Apple menu.
Now, you mentioned a special menu a minute ago. What's that for?
The special menu is actually one of the best things about this application. What it does is it kind of bundles a whole bunch of features that don't fit into the other menus. And I think it's actually where the real power of this application lies. So it gives you access to mounted drives. You can just navigate straight through your hard drive from the menu bar. It gives you access to recent folders. There's a bit of information there about your Mac's memory and its uptime. And really usefully as well, it also enables you to access all of your iPhoto contents. You can preview images and open them in another application. Finally, there's also access to address book items as well.
That's really great functionality. I think you can really get to things very simply and easily. Okay, now you gave Application Wizard a rating of 4 out of 5. What was your thinking behind that?
Well, I think it's a very interesting take on app launching. It offers something that is genuinely different to all of the other launchers out there. And I actually enjoyed working with it. I did question slightly whether people would be able to sort of adapt their workflow around it. It's a bit weird in some ways. It's mm-hmm. very different to what people are used to.
Right.
And really, the interface isn't intuitive enough. It's a little bit, a bit too left field. The colours aren't very obvious, and those aspects can't be customised enough. But other than that, it is an interesting take, and it's still well worth having a look at.
All right, so that's Application Wizard from Mapasoft, 4 out of 5 stars from Craig, about £10, and it is the shareware product of the month for September. Our second product is Simple Windows Sets version 2.0. It is from hamsoftengineering.com. Don't forget, you can get through it through the Enhanced Podcast link. It's about $13 or about £7. So what does Simple Windows Sets do, Craig?
Well, it's actually a very, very, very simple app, but it's something I've been looking for absolutely ages now, or at least a decent sort of implementation of this idea. Mm-hmm. What it enables you to do is define and manage sets of Finder windows.
Oh, no, that sounds great. So what can you use it for?
Personally, I use it for managing projects. So I work on a lot of websites, and I need multiple windows. So I use my sites folder, I use my documents folder, I use my photos folder. And so for each project, I can sort of manage all of the Finder windows, set them up exactly just so, and then I can use simple window sets to save that set. And the thing is, then if Finder crashes, which frankly it does far more often than it should do, I don't lose my setup. I just go straight back into Finder window sets and bosh, there's my setup again. And of course, if I'm working on a whole bunch of different projects, I can flick between them really quickly rather than sort of wasting time every single time getting the right folders up on the screen.
Okay, so it's a great time saver. I mean, how do you manage these sets that you were talking about?
There's a really, really simple manager. It basically gives you a bunch of four buttons, which are restore, update, delete, and new set. And they all do exactly what you'd expect. And so to change a set, all you have to do is restore it, as in, that brings the windows back up again. Then you can amend the windows, add new ones, resize them, do whatever you want, and then click update. It's that simple.
So it really gives you a lot more control over your Finder window. I mean, this is a really simple product done pretty well, right?
I think it's one of those sort of things that I kind of champion a lot in this podcast and in my pages in Mac format. It's a simple product, it's honed down, and it's very, very well done. There's, no bloat there. And I think the author's really thought about how Finder window should work. I mean, it gives you a bunch of additional options as well. So when you're restoring a set, it doesn't wipe anything out unless you want it to. You can actually append to existing windows, or you can get rid of whatever's on the screen and replace it. It's kind of down to you. And then there are things like there are tiling options. There's a close all windows option as well. And the only niggling factor I found in the entire app is that it can't cope with smart folders and the trash. But the thing is, that's a really minor thing. And as soon as you know about it, you work around it. It's not a problem. And so that wasn't enough for me to say this shouldn't be getting anything other than 5 out of 5. I think this is a really great app.
All right, so that's Simple Window Sets, 5 out of 5, a Mac choice from Craig. And those are the two products that we have this month, Simple Window Sets and Application Wizard. And again, you can get through it through the Enhanced Podcast link, and you want to look for the reviews in the September issue. Craig, thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next month.
Yep, see you next month.
Craig Grinnell reviews shareware for Mac Format Magazine. His reviews for September are on page 100. The final segment of our show every episode is Questions and Answers with Trevor Middleton. You can send him your questions, and he will do his best to answer them. And he's with us again to go over some of your questions. Hello, Trevor.
Hey, Brent. How are you doing?
Very good. Let me tell people that you can always email Trevor at machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And don't forget to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. Question one is from Stuart Gordon in Slough, Great Britain, who wrote us, I have just updated the software on my iPod Touch to version 2.0, and this is the first time I've gotten mail on it. But I'm unable to get my mail account to work on the Touch. It is an Exchange account that is working on my Mac Pro, running version 10.5.4 of the OS, but whenever I try and set up the same account on my Touch, it fails to connect. I noticed on the tab in iTunes that there's a section to sync selected mail accounts, but this doesn't show my mail account on my Mac Pro, and it will not copy over the settings as it seems to suggest it will. How can I fix this? Trevor.
For those of you who don't know, Exchange is a server-based system used in a lot of large organizations, and that pushes information such as email and appointments to client software such as Outlook and, on Macs, Entourage. Now, the iPod Touch is able to take advantage of that now, as is the iPhone, of course. Now, there have been a few instances of Exchange not working exactly as you describe, and that was because the client account has SSL enabled by default on the iPod Touch, and the main Exchange server didn't have SSL. Now, what I would do, Stuart, as I don't know exactly the settings they're using at your organization, is have a chat with your IT guys, confirm the settings that they're using, and set up an account manually with the correct settings.
All right, question two is from Darren Wells of Newbury, Great Britain, who writes, I've got an ongoing issue where I can't share my master iTunes library on my 20-inch iMac to my older G4 machine. Although it's occasionally visible from the G4, it typically isn't. I've reinstalled macOS 10.4 on the G4 and recently upgraded the 20-inch iMac to Leopard, but still no joy. Leopard sees the G4 in its Finder shared list, but iTunes on the G4 doesn't see the shared library. What's going on here, Trevor?
Okay, well, it sounds as though, in this case, the iTunes library has been moved from one Mac to the other. In cases like this, you can then have problems finding your iTunes library. Now, there are a couple of ways of telling the G4 where the library now is. Either go into iTunes Preferences, choose Advanced, and then General, and right at the top of that window, there's a section that allows you to change the location of your default iTunes library by clicking on the Change button. Or, more simply, just hold down the Alt key on your keyboard as you launch iTunes, and you'll be prompted to tell iTunes exactly where your library is so that it knows next time. Brad.
All right, and our final question is from Drew Freeman of Plum, Pennsylvania. He wrote us, I have a music CD collection of 10,000 discs. That's a lot of discs. And I have decided to rip the songs at a high bit rate in iTunes, and I've checked to use Apple's error correction in preferences under importing. On some discs that appear perfect to the eye, the disc hang up and just spin in the drive. iTunes then freezes and crashes, and I have to force quit. I clean and buff each CD before I insert it into the drive, but the problem is continuing. Now, oddly enough, when I turn the MacBook at a 90-degree angle and lay it on its screen back, this will make it import a track, but sometimes not. Another issue is that some CDs are spit out of the drive as they're bad. Now, what is perplexing is that all these discs worked fine on the old iMac DV with an old version of iTunes. So, what's going on here? Trevor.
Does sound, Drew, as though you have another duff optical drive in that MacBook. What I try to do is get hold of an external drive just to see if that works with a couple of the discs you've had problems with. Other than that, I would take that MacBook back to your local authorized service provider and get it tested. Brad.
Yeah, it sure does sound like it's a drive, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Trevor, thanks so much for helping us this time around. We'll see you again.
Okay, no problem. See you next time.
You can send Trevor your questions to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And don't forget to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to Chris Finn, David Marr Roberts, Cliff Joseph, Craig Grinnell, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Sakleropoulou. You can always send us your comments and suggestions to macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. Join us again for our next edition on Monday, the 29th of September. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.